TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, The 1% Pathology and the Myth of Capitalism. Dr. Michael Parenti gave this keynote speech for the 4th Annual People's Movement Assembly at Evergreen State College, Olympia, Washington, in October 2012. He talked about economics, neoliberalism, globalization, and the history of capitalism. Parenti spoke and wrote about these topics long before most other academics dared mention and much less critique capitalism, the chosen economic form in the US and really much of the world. Raised in a working-class Italian family in East Harlem, New York City, Parenti went on to receive his PhD in political science at Yale in 1962. His academic career was cut short by his dismissal after he was arrested for protesting the U.S. war on Vietnam. Parenti became an independent scholar, lecturer, and author of over 20 books, and he remained an activist as well. Here is Michael Parenti.
I want to point out, you know, that in every class society that's ever existed, the ruling elements do not rule nakedly. They always adorn their rule with myths or themes and symbols to justify their privileged positions at the apex of the social pyramid. So the 1% spins its self-legitimating myths. I tell students when they say, oh, they don't care what we think, they ignore us and all that. I say, oh, no, no, that's the only thing they care about you. The only thing they care about you is what you're thinking. They don't care if you eat correctly. They don't care how your living conditions are. They don't care that they've built up an inhuman and irrational traffic system that's strangulating us and polluting our air. They don't care about anything. The only thing about you they care about is what you're thinking. In the morning, they start, what's going to be the story today? How do we manipulate? How do we control? How do we contain? How do we influence? How do we act upon what it is that they have in their minds? Modern capitalist societies avoid telling the truth about themselves. Instead, we get those rag-to-riches mythologies, the Horatio Alger stories, myths about fair play, equal opportunity, self-reliance, freedom, liberty, all those kind of things that they feed us again and again. The two fundamental myths of modern corporate capitalism that I want to treat are the myth that capitalism creates a general prosperity and a well-being, material well-being. Myth number two, that capitalism creates or bolsters democracy. We even hear the phrase capitalist democracies, Western capitalist democracies and the like. Let me start with the one about prosperity. Before I get into that, there's another secondary myth I want to put aside. When I'm talking about capitalism, I'm talking about giant corporate capitalism, okay? I'm not talking about mom and pop small businesses. Mom and pop businesses are the squirrels that dance among the elephants. I'm talking about the giant multi-billion dollar corporations, the ones that are too big to fail. They get bailouts. Mom and pop, if you fail, you go down, you sink, and you drown on your own. We're talking about transnational corporations and banks. You know, Lenin himself dealt with that question. He said, 10 million small businesses count for nothing. A few giant cartels count for everything. He was talking in terms of power. Who's shaping the condition of our lives? Who determines the quality of the air we breathe, the food we eat, the water we drink, the kind of jobs we can have, the images we have to deal with and such? That's not mom and pop. The prosperity myth, that it creates prosperity. Corporations have given us wonderful things, and wonderful for them. Consider some consumer realities. The replacement of public nonprofit rail transit systems with polluting, expensive automotive transit systems involving billion-dollar highway systems, millions killed or maimed over the decades. Well, as LA had before General Motors bought up all the tracks, ripped them all up, and made people ride buses, and then finally got rid of most of the buses and made people buy their own cars. The replacement of local organic food supplies with pesticide-ridden factory farms, genetically modified foods, antibiotic-ridden meats, shipped long distances. For a long time, this has changed for the better, a tobacco industry, several generations of lung cancer, with, you remember that wonderful film of the Senate hearings, the CEOs from Liggett and Myers and all the other tobacco companies, and each one of them said, no, caffeine is not addictive, said that. And they all knew, meanwhile, the evidence finally came up, they all knew it was addictive, and they all were deliberately injecting more caffeine into the cigarettes so that they would be, nicotine, thank you. Oh, what am I smoking? Okay, nicotine, I mean. I'm glad you're with me. Don't be so picky. These guys should be in jail. That's called perjury. They lied under oath to Congress. They should be in jail. They never went to jail. But unfortunately, cigarette consumption has stopped declining in America. It's kind of leveled off now. And it's increasing dramatically in the third world. What the cigarette companies did is start moving out to the third world. Cigarettes became the cool thing in a lot of other countries, Asia, Africa, places like that. Unsafe at any price. And there's an avalanche of disposable products, cosmetic, medical, whatever, products that keep creating solutions for things that are not problems, trying to get you, convince you that you have this need or that problem and you should buy this and have that. The history of capitalism has been a history of both great prosperity and great poverty. We often note how unfortunate that so much wealth here with so much poverty right here. And in fact, there's a dynamic interaction between those two things. This poverty exists because of this wealth. This wealth exists because of this poverty. The wealth of the few rests on the poverty of the many. There could not be epauci, as Cicero called them. Epauci, P-A-U-C-I, Latin it is, it meant the few, the really elite group that ruled the Roman Senate, that inner group, the richest, most powerful men run Roman Senate. They could not have ruled and lived the way they want unless they had slaves and proletariat, impoverished people who worked for bare subsistence. There could be no lords and ladies without serfs who labor from dawn to dusk to keep the lords and ladies in the style to which they are accustomed. There could be no corporate capitalists without workers and indentured workers and debtors and taxpayers and all sorts of other people. So there's a real relationship between wealth and poverty. I'll return to that in a minute. I just want to say something else. Do the 1%, that top plutocracy, which you know it's really not 1%, you know that, don't you? 1% would be 3 million people. It's really more like a fraction, about 1/4 of 1/10 of 1%. It's about 120,000 people who really compose the super rich and have the wealth of America. And when people say, whoa, you know, that top 1% has as much wealth as the bottom 30 or 40%, that's not true at all. The bottom 30, 40% has nothing. I don't know why people are saying that. Robert Reich, I heard him say that. The 140 richest billionaires have as much wealth as the poorest, 75 million people. The poorest 75 million in America don't have a pot to spit in. Most of them are in debt. Most of them are maxing out on their credit cards. Most of them are just barely getting by. How are you comparing these two? What kind of a dazzling statistic is that supposed to be? But does that 1% believe their own mythologies? Yes, of course, people believe in their own virtue. Yes, of course, they believe in their own value to society. Of course, you think Mitt Romney doesn't? He thinks he's God's gift. Well, he's got a special problem with the Mormon stuff and all that. But he thinks he's God's gift to society. For the most part, the class propaganda they put out elevates them, justifies their worth. So why would they not believe it? They find it very persuasive. We all find things very persuasive that are flattering to us, rather things that are critical of us. You don't know what you're talking about. What do you mean? That's what you get. But when someone says something that's positive, you say, "Oh, you really think so? Hey, It elevates them. It justifies their wealth. So why would they not believe it? It's very persuasive because it serves their interests. They believe that the poor are the authors of their own poverty. They believe their own wealth is earned and socially useful. It creates jobs. It provides growth. They believe the free market system is the most productive and beneficial in history. They believe competing systems and reforms and government regulations are harmful and distract from the performance. They believe that government should not be a nanny state tending to the needs of the needy. Let them learn self-reliance, those people down there with their hands out. At the same time, they overlook the fact that their own class is not at all self-reliant. No one is more reliant on government handouts than corporate America. They get tax breaks, more than you and I get. They get about $100 billion a year out of every budget in direct subsidies. Everything that they produce is, almost everything is subsidized by the government. They get loan guarantees. They get export subsidies. They get equity grants and land giveaways. They get almost free leases on a lot of government land to do what? Harvest the timber, or mine the copper, or drill for the oil. They get oil. They get oil giveaways practically, or leases, or the land. I mean, it'll be estimated that there's a $15 billion worth of oil in a certain reserve on the government land, and they'll lease it. The government will lease it to them for like $500,000 or $1 million peanuts or something, so they can go ahead and take that. That's stealing from the public treasury. The airwaves. They get to lease the airwaves for a song. For a song, Fox News gets to get these airwaves. The airwaves, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, the airwaves are the property of the people of the United States. You'd never know it, though. They're sent out and they're used to great profit by the media corporations and their advertisers and the like. And they get bailouts. They get billion-dollar bailouts. Mom and pop doesn't get a bailout. If things go down, you go out of business, you lose your grocery store, you lose your little cafe, whatever it is. Federal government does not give you a bailout and say, "Hey, you're too small to fail. Let's give you some more money to boost you up here a little bit." That doesn't happen. Big corporate capitalism, besides being hypocritical, self-deluding, and deluding us, is also a irrational system. Marx said it was a ruthlessly rational system that demystified and shattered the Dark Ages. You know, there's that incredible paragraph in the Communist Manifesto where Marx and Engels talk about the dynamic, productive energy of capitalism and how it broke loose from the shackles of 1,000 years of the Dark Ages. And if you read, you know, and if you read the Enlightenment writers, I had a book of the book, an anthology of the Enlightenment. I started reading them. I was so struck. I mean, I was just so struck by how naively enthusiastic they are. I mean, just the like a Ben Franklin or people like that. They were just there at the edge, knowing that the world was opening up. And I said, I've got to be a little more generous to these guys. They're coming down from 1,000 years of the Dark Ages. They're coming down from a civilization that condemned the Paris Medical Society and the medical school in Paris for what? You know what they condemned Paris for? Empiricism. They said, Paris medicine suffers from empiricism. This was back during the time of Louis XIV, Louis XIV or so. That empiricism, that is, they were doing things like cutting open cadavers and looking and learning what the body really was about and where it was and what happened and doing that sort of thing, rather than using the Bible as its authority for judging why someone is sick, and there are four humors, there are five this, and there are seven that, and you make these old superstitious deductions, and then you gave the guy whatever it is, the eyeballs of a frog and to eat, or and he has to say 10 Our Fathers, and that would make him better. So the people of the Enlightenment are coming down from that, and the whole world is opening up. And Marx is pointing out, from the late 18th century right up to his day, which is the middle of the 19th century, in that 60 years, they saw all sorts of sciences emerging. They saw continents being subdued, canals being dug, the canals then being ignored because they were building railroads now across the stretches of land. And they saw this incredible burgeoning of mills and mines and all this sort of dynamic explosion. So this, Marx says, is really a very impressive thing. It is. But it becomes irrational in its social relations. I would also add that capitalism is amazingly irrational in regard to the environment. It explicitly ignores the environment, if you know what I mean. And it doesn't really ignore environmentalism. More than ignoring environmentalism, it condemns environmentalism. It attacks it. It has pejorative terms like tree huggers. What are some of those other terms? Eco-terrorists, right. Eco-terrorists, what are they talking about? They're the eco-terrorists. So they're irrational in regard to the environment. They treat the environment, first of all, they treat it and its resources as limitless, and that's incorrect. We now know most of our topsoil is almost gone, and the environment is not limitless. That's one. And they also treat the environment as disposable. It's a disposable environment. You can use up some stuff here and turn it all into wasteland and toss it aside and move on to somewhere else and do the same. Capitalism's crises are not exceptional. They are the common mode. In other words, under modern corporate capitalism, the irrational, the wasteful, the destructive, the impoverishing, all of that is the norm. Normal, balanced, productive, calm, equitable social relations and periods are the exception. Crises, panics, recession, crises again, that's the norm of capitalism. In the late 1780s, we had debtor rebellions in America. Shays Rebellion, the best known one maybe, but others too. After the American Revolution, we had monetary crises. Then there was the Panic of 1792. The Panic of 1809, which lasted a number of years. The Panic of 1819. The Panic of 1837. Let's skip the rest of the 19th century. You can go on to the very end of the century. That decade of 1890 where the economy, the U.S. already was the leading manufacturing country in the world, and yet that whole decade, 1890s, they couldn't pull out of the recession. They were having a tough time. Teddy Roosevelt said, "We need a war, any war, let's have a war." They were looking for a war, very explicitly. War would do two things. One, it would stimulate the economy and get it going, and two, it would distract people from their economic grievances and get them flag waving, which indeed it did with the Spanish-American War. All through the 20th century, wars and recessions, we know the 1920s as the jazz age, Charleston, and things were great. The 1920s were a period of severe recession, especially in agrarian areas, less so in the cities. After that came the Great Depression, as you know, 1929, and that lasted right on up to 1941 when World War II began. All through the 20th century, we've had wars, recessions, inflation, market crashes, investor panics, depressions, massive deficits, bubbles and bailouts and subsidies. Hardly a normal year. When you got the free market, that market ain't so free. It is a system that can never settle with itself. The corporate crimes and crises we endure are not irrational departures from a rational system. It's not that this is an irrational time or a crazy time. It's the converse, just the converse of that. They are the rational outcomes of a basically amoral and irrational system. When you've got that kind of system, this is what you're going to get. It's not that these are just some deviancy, some real bad things, some Bernie Madoffs did this and now it's all upset and all that. No, that doesn't work. The system puts forth these people and rewards them tremendously. John Maynard Keynes, the guru of liberal capitalism, and Keynes is looking pretty good nowadays, but it's hard that with the free market orthodoxy prevails in much of academia in economic departments that you can't even read Keynes anyway. It makes a lot of sense. He made this point. Now, he was the guru of liberal capitalism, but he was not his shill. He wasn't his shill. He was not selling it. He was quite critical of capitalism. And he said, quote, "What an astonishing idea that the most wickedest of men," he uses a double superlative there, he uses bad grammar to be cute, to sort of emphasize the point. He says, "What an astonishing idea that the most wickedest of men doing the most wickedest of things will produce beneficial results." That's what he was saying. When the Depression came, he said, whatever could you possibly have thought was going to happen if you leave these people to be doing all this stuff? People who are not known for their human empathy or their willingness to sacrifice and share. And even if they were known for that, they seem to lose it once they get into this game. Corporate America and both of its major parties and both political parties are in the service of corporate America. The leader of the Democratic Party, Barack Obama, in the debate just last week with Romney, made his profession to the free enterprise capitalist system. He said that. You know, he very explicitly made that point. They're wedded to a system that brings poverty and hard times and attrition. Most of the world is capitalist, and most of the world is poor. Capitalist Nigeria, capitalist Indonesia, capitalist Mexico, capitalist Thailand, capitalist South Africa. I said, capitalism creates immense prosperity for a few, but it creates immense poverty, and here it is. All of these capitalist countries, they're usually not even thought of as capitalist countries, isn't that right? They're just thought of as third world countries. No, they're capitalists. They're big companies that are in there, and they hire people, and they got mines and mills and whatever else. And as capitalism spreads and grows all over these worlds, so does poverty. The number of people living in poverty is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. Did you get that? So that poverty is spreading, in other words, spreading even as wealth accumulates. Even in the United States, in 1900, the United States was a third world country, 50 years before the term was invented. We had typhoid epidemics in Philadelphia and Baltimore and places like that. We had chronic and mass underemployment, chronic and mass poverty. We had all the diseases of poverty too, tuberculosis, malnutrition, rickets, and the like. I remember as a kid, tuberculosis and rickets, you know, those were still diseases to be dealt with. The great American prosperity, America as the land of prosperity, is a myth. It didn't exist. the Great Depression came along. At the same time, Western Europe, those great, wonderful social democracies like Finland and Denmark and Norway and Sweden, and where life and social services have been better for a while, they were third world countries too. People were living hard and mean lives in those countries too. World War II brought a massive increase in spending in America. There were three things that led to the American prosperity that came. That prosperity started developing 1945, 46, 47, in the 1940s.
That was part one of a full hour talk on the 1% pathology and the myth of capitalism by Dr. Michael Parenti. He spoke in October 2012 at Evergreen College, Olympia, Washington. Come back for TUC Radio's next broadcast to hear Parenti's explanation as to what exactly led to the post-World War II prosperity in the U.S. Michael Parenti is an internationally recognized scholar and activist on capitalism, globalism, imperialism, political economy, and class power. The worldwide emergence of movements that aim to fundamentally change the banking system and the economy and critique what goes for democracy these days. Find inspiration and information in Parenti's over 20 books and many recorded and filmed lectures going back several decades. Much of Parenti's spoken word is archived on TUC Radio's website and free for download. Many thanks to Ed Mays of Pirate TV Seattle for this recording. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. If you would like to purchase an audio CD of the full one-hour talk by Michael Parenti, The 1% Pathology and the Myth of Capitalism, call 1-707-463-2654 for information, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and on the web, and depends on the support of listeners like you. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.